Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be checking in with Adam Boileau in just a moment and talking through all the week's security news, and then we will be hearing from this week's sponsor guest, HD Moore. HD is the founder of Rumble, the asset discovery tool that you can run on your network, and he is joining us to talk about some new tricks he's added to the product, like integrations with cloud service APIs and external discovery products like Census. So Rumble's motto is, we eat the whole buffalo. And as you'll hear, they're kind of running out of buffalo because you say that and then they keep finding more tricks, right? More meat from the buffalo. So yeah, that interview with HD Moore is coming up after this week's news segment with Adam Boileau, which is going to start in a moment. But just before we get going, I will just mention I've been quite sick over the last week or so I'm not feeling all that sharp. So apologies in advance if I'm a little bit off my game this week. Let's get into the news now. And Adam, we're going to start off with a couple of reports here about different watering hole attacks that both look really interesting. And I think the interesting thing about these is they were both using, you know, both doing watering hole O-Day sprays, right? Which isn't something you see every day. The first report we're looking at is based on some research out of ESET. Kevin Collier wrote it up for NBC News. And yeah, it looks at a campaign by Kandaroo, which apparently hacked a UK-based Middle East news site and was, hosing people with O-Day, which is not what you want.
No, and it's an interesting campaign because, it's certainly targeted, at topical events around the Middle East. ESET's written up the campaign. Obviously, there was a number of other sites that were also included in the same sorts of sets of infrastructure and attacks. And there's one of those ones where you line up the set of interests of the various places used as watering holes, and you kind of get some pictures about what's going on. Plenty of targets in Yemen, TV stations linked to Hezbollah, Syrian Ministry of Electricity, a bunch of other things, as well as commentary around what's going on in the Middle East. So pretty topical place, and Kandaroo's techniques there seem to have been quite effective. Watering holes have always been effective when you can target them to interest groups, and this seems like what's happened.
Yeah. Now, Kandaroo, of course, is one of the Israeli firms that has been blacklisted by the United States government. And, I think it's pretty brazen, right? Like owning up a news website in one of the Five Eyes countries to drop exploits on people. That's going to piss people off, right? Let's be honest.
Well, yes, I think it is in the middle of pissing people off. And it's kind of interesting, comparing and contrasting Kandaroo and NSO here. Like NSO is such a, public company and very visible and has said a lot of things about how they control how their tools are used. And we can argue about, the extent to which that has happened. Whereas Kandaroo is very, very quiet, very private, doesn't have much presence. And also does not appear to have much control about how their stuff is used. But in this case, you do wonder, looking at the targeting list, who is behind it, whose bidding they were doing here. And it's just, I thought the contrast is interesting, given we're talking about two Israeli firms with quite different approaches and yet, similar levels of pissed-offedness.
Yeah. And we've got another watering hole written up here, apparently targeting users in Hong Kong. I wonder who could be behind that one, Adam. But yeah, there's a write-up from Google Tag, and looks like maybe a combo between O-Day and N-Day vulnerabilities targeting, iOS and macOS? Is that right?
Yeah, Tag writes up that there was evidence that there was an iOS exploit, but they didn't manage to capture it and when they went past the site and with the data and telemetry they had. And there was also a macOS exploit targeting a Safari bug and then a local Prevesk. It was a little unclear which bits were 0-day, which bits are N-day. There was also some target vectoring between different versions of macOS. I think Tag suggested that maybe one of the bugs had been fixed in Mojave, but it hadn't been fixed in Catalina or some kind of combination like that. But anyway, there's quite a good write-up of the technical aspects of it. One thing that is interesting is one of the bugs, the local Prevesk, kernel Prevesk on macOS, was presented by Pangolab in a public talk earlier this year. So that's interesting.
Now, look, the most interesting story this week comes to us from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. And, this just filled in so many blanks for me. As regular listeners would know, when we're talking about NSO, I was always sort of skeptical of the scale of the activity attributed to NSO, because I'm like, how could one company be behind so much nefarious business, right? And this story explains it. It is a completely believable explanation. Adam, walk us through this one.
Yeah, so this story brings in a bunch of kind of domestic political, you know, personalities and things, you know, kind of relationships between parties in NSO and in Israeli government and defense apparatus that does, as you say, kind of explain how this picture fits together. And obviously looking from the outside, you know, we are not super familiar with Israeli domestic politics and the people involved. But yeah, the story kind of lines up, you know, some of the parts of, you know, people who've been in government and are looking for sweet roles in the private sector afterwards, of personal relationships between people in leadership roles at NSO and in various arms of the government, and indeed some of the way that the tools produced by NSO, you know, are used domestically by Israeli security services and by, you know, other parts of the Israeli government, and also are used, you know, in kind of support of their international relations, their other, you know, kind of countries that they, you know, are keen to work with, and kind of facilitating NSO's, you know, export of you know, cyber arms.
So this is the part that I found very, very, very interesting. Is this story basically says that Benjamin Netanyahu, when he was the Prime Minister of Israel, was using NSO as a olive branch to other countries in the region, right? So and using the sale of NSO as a capability to try to butter up the UAE, Morocco, Azerbaijan, Saudi Arabia, right? So from Netanyahu's point of view, he's like, we'll sell them this technology, they get this incredible capability, and we use this to develop closer diplomatic ties, which is going to play well politically back home. So this kind of explains why NSO could have risen to the scale that it's at. And I think from Israel's perspective, there are other benefits to this as well, because if you're selling these countries these incredible capabilities, they've got less of an incentive to develop their own, which they're going to use to target you, right?
So exactly, yes. And you get to control their future use and the capability, right? I mean, because developing this tooling in, you know, in your own country has a long tail, right? All those capabilities that you build up once, all the people who built it can go on and do other things. Like, it develops the local workforce, whereas selling them capability they can just use off the shelf doesn't have that kind of uplift.
Yeah, so in this case, in terms of skills, you get to defang your adversaries by providing them with their offensive tooling, right? You get better diplomatic relations. I mean, it looks great, okay? It looks very great when Israel's trying to form these alliances in a very unstable part of the world, for them at least, right? The problem is that Saudi Arabia, by the looks of things, were using this technology to help facilitate the bone sawing of a journalist, for example. The problem is the facilitation of widespread, you know, human rights abuses using this technology, right? So you can see why, you know, for the Israeli government, this would be a great approach. But it's also a very, you know, in my mind, it is immoral if this story is accurate, that they've been deliberately supplying as a part of government policy, right? Deliberately supplying this stuff to countries they knew would abuse it.
Yeah, I mean, that's it in a nutshell, right? This does really not look great when laid out like this. And, you know, when we've seen, you know, was it the ruler of Dubai using it to hack his ex-wife during divorce proceedings? Like, that's pretty hard to make claims that that's a legitimate use of any, you know, that's just not acceptable, right? That's a crappy thing to do on a personal level, and that's a thing that, you know, a government that the Israelis would support the, you know, UAE to do does look a bit crappy. And yeah, the, you know, all the other relationships that kind of fit together here, you know, I imagine that we've got some Israeli listeners for whom, you know, maybe this was already obvious, and maybe, you know, as outsiders, we didn't really understand this, but, you know, maybe this was already understood. But yeah, from the outside, this explains a lot.
Yeah, no, it really does. And to me, the thing that was just blowing my mind is, like, how could they be used, like, you know, almost as a pseudo-sovereign capability by so many countries? It doesn't make sense. And now it makes sense, right? When you've got the actual government itself using this as, like, a package deal to, like, you know, here, have this thing and, you know, we can be friends. And yeah,
it's kind of, you know, it has some parallels to Chinese Belt and Road in a way, like, you know, making this kind of infrastructure available so that they are dependent on you, so that you have some control over how it's used, so that you can promote relationships for, you know, domestic or and foreign political positioning.
Yeah, but there's a difference between concessionary loans to build infrastructure and selling people these sort of tools that are being turned against civil society, okay, right? Yes. So, you know, I get, I get the metaphor you're going for there, but it's, you know, yeah, it's like the Belt and Road, but evil. You know?
I think there's people that would argue the Belt and Road is also evil. But, you know,
I don't know, man. That's a complicated one. Anyway, and look, this one, really, this next story we're going to talk about, it kind of slid under the radar, but I found it very interesting. Facebook actually released a bunch of info about some campaigns it had observed, including one being run by the Syrian Air Force Intelligence Directorate. So they actually did an attribution to, the Syrian Armed Forces on a campaign, which is the first time Facebook's done something like that. Catalin Kimpanu wrote it up for the Record, but crickets everywhere else.
Yeah, this is quite an interesting story. They look at these campaigns from the Syrian government, you know, targeting opponents of the Assad regime there. They also look at some campaigns by Pakistanis targeting the previous Afghan government with, like, fake Android app stores. So they, you know, send people links to chat apps to, you know, communicate with people, and then they had a whole fake app store with a bunch of, you know, Trojan games and Trojan chat apps and things. So interesting set of campaigns. And as you said, like, the fact that Facebook is, you know, actually starting to come out and attribute some of this stuff is interesting. They've done some attribution previously to some other groups out of China and Iran and stuff. But seeing individual private companies actually going out there and making attributions to governments is a useful thing for us to do, because it's too much kind of wishy-washy. We don't want to say, you know, half attribution, you know, in this industry.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes people get it wrong, right? We got one of them this week. We got one of them we'll be talking about soon. Just between the Pakistanis catfishing Afghan government figures, trying to get them to, like, sideload shady Android apps, and then, the other Syria-based stuff. Like, good work from Facebook. Anyway, that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
There is a link in this week's show notes. And I see it's been written up in a couple of places, but I was just sort of surprised it didn't make bigger news. But anyway, what do we got here? And, interesting one from Tom Brewster here. It looks like Tom has been chatting with a Dutch researcher who's been looking at a group called Rocket Hack. Now, they seem a little bit similar to, like, Beltrox, the Indian hacker for hire business, but based out of Russia. And, you know, just doing that low-grade sort of we'll spearfish Gmail accounts for you sort of thing. But I think what's interesting about this is I think we're going to see more and more shady outfits like this operating, because it's quite a safe way. You know, in the case of Beltrox, it's been thought that some US corporations were using Beltrox to hack the email accounts of activists and stuff so that they could keep tabs on them. Now, if you do that through a private investigator who's then sending money to an obscure company in India, like, it's very unlikely that you're going to get caught. And then when you throw this company into the mix based in Russia, it's even less likely that they're going to get caught. So I'd imagine we're going to see more of this, Adam. Was that what you felt reading this?
Yeah, it's a thing I think we are going to see more of. And obviously, as you say, like, there is a market for this kind of service. And, you know, ransomware has been pushing enterprise security to be taken a bit more seriously. And there's a bunch of skills that have been developed honed in the ransomware cybercrime world, who, when corporate security gets better and the pressure on ransomware crews starts to ratchet up, will look for other lines of employment using the skills they've got. And this kind of, you know, individually targeted hacking, for corporate interests or whatever else, like, you know, on the underground, like, that's a thing that's going to attract way less attention than ransomware and oil pipeline, but, you know, many similar sets of skills. So I think the pool of people who can do this and will have to change job in the next couple of years probably means that we'll see an uptick as well. And hopefully some of the people that do end up doing this have better infrastructure security than this Rocket Hack crew, because that the researcher that the story is based on apparently just, like, logged into their back-end control panel with no auth, like, just found their C2 infrastructure, logged in, and was able to kind of watch them going about their business. And he's got, as a result, great data about, 3,500 people that they hacked across, a real grab bag of targets and industries and people.
Activists, journalists, IVF doctors, like 70 of them, which is a bit interesting. And but that's the thing. You wind up with a diverse target set when you're doing this stuff for money for, you know, whoever will pay, right? Like, that's just how it works.
Yeah, exactly, right? And that's certainly if you've got the kind of visibility where you can see the back end infrastructure, you very quickly get a feel for, you know, what the motivations of the group are. And, like, when we saw the list of people being targeted in that previous hack, previous campaign, around the Middle East, you can kind of look at whose interests are aligned. And then when you see one like this, which is just a, splatter, of completely unrelated things, you can get a feel that this is a commercial hack for a hire operation.
Or as the media prefers to call them, cyber mercenaries. Cyber mercs, man. Cyber mercs. But
very reasonably priced cyber mercs, I might add.
But that's the thing, they do it for cheap, and they got they got malware and stuff as well, these guys. Like, they're not just doing phishing. So I don't know. I mean, you're never going to see the super elite stuff, but you don't need super elite stuff to own consumer grade stuff. So, who are going to be the customers? I'd imagine there'd be a few governments. I imagine there would be, organizations like hedge funds that want to get financial intelligence, things like that. I mean, they're known to do greasy stuff like this, right? Especially when they can use a cutout. Yeah, like a private investigator who then goes and procures the information this way, and they can always play dumb. No, thought they were getting it through open channels,
Yeah, exactly. Parallel construct it through a more legal means or whatever else. There's lots of people who would be interested. And of course also, if you're law enforcement and you can't be bothered going through the, normal channels, maybe you've got other options available to you. I don't know.
Meanwhile, there's a group called Moses Staff, apparently, which is going around targeting Israeli organizations, doing destructive attacks. Looks like ransomware, not ransomware. So, brave, whoever they are.
Yeah, that's certainly your OPSEC better be real tight. They've been going in and hacking, a bunch of organizations around Israel using pretty standard ransomware tech, kind of normal intrusion techniques we'd see from ransomware crews, busting in through Exchange, privesking the domain. And then they're using like an open source descriptor, encrypting a bunch of stuff, leaving a ransomware, and then actually no, it's just there to disrupt things. And they've got a kind of a darknet leak site where they're talking about their victims, but mostly it's just like it's a trophy list rather than an attempt to solicit money from people. But I guess we'll see how long that lasts, because Israel probably not going to take super kindly to that.
Hey, this isn't in the run sheet, but I saw an interesting tweet actually from Kevin Beaumont the other day talking about how some ransomware crews now are using BitLocker, native Microsoft BitLocker. So they basically get in, get the domain, and then they push out, a new BitLocker key and then torch it off the air.
I mean, that's a beautiful thing. That's living off the land, taken to the, to the end of its, to its logical conclusion. It's a beautiful thing. And Lordy, is that going to cause problems if we start seeing that in widespread use? Because
it's smart. That makes a lot of sense. The sort of thing that Microsoft can introduce some measures to, you would think, to make it harder to do that stuff because it has to be done at one point. But the thing that left me cold about it is say you've got your CrowdStrike and you've got it dialed up to aggressive or whatever, most of the time you're going to be okay when it comes to ransomware actors going after you, or if you're, doing allow listing or something like that. But then someone uses native Windows functions to do this. Like, what's your control there,
Exactly. Yes. I don't know. That's a hats off to you, whoever, built that as a proof of concept, because that's a great idea and I wish I'd thought of it. That's just real good.
It is. We got a bit of a comedy story next, which we're going to talk about it. Someone spamming troll cyber alerts from the FBI email service because they misconfigured them somehow.
Yes, there was a whole bunch of emails sent out pretty early in the morning a few days ago and had, contents that made no sense, but basically tried to say that the FBI has detected a nation state attackers in your environment, specifically Vinnie Troyer is doing it, that guy, but we can't arrest him because he's also our informant, and, didn't make a whole bunch of sense, but it was also, the sort of thing that if you were a blue team in a SOC, you can't just immediately put it in the bin. You probably have to call someone, at least have a meeting.
Pages going off sort of thing,
And, mail headers, it's DKIM signed. Like, legit came from at least a box at the FBI. It does look like they had misconfigured something in some portal. And, we don't know whether it was, code exec or whether it's just they had a mail.
It's like open relay, mail. but the 2021 equivalent of that,
Yeah, so I don't really know how. FBI's taken the box offline and said, yes, a bad thing happened. We haven't given any specifics yet. InfoSec Twitter was having a bit of a meltdown about that one.
InfoSec Twitter was somewhat unforgiving, but they deserve to eat it on this. Come on.
They kind of do. But it was just if you had done a slightly better email, and obviously it was just kind of trolling, but Yeah. This seems like there's so much. Well, I guess I like the lulls, and maybe the lulls is better than actually doing a good job of this. But you know, you could have used this film so much more. But
yeah, so Vinny Troyer of Night Lion Security, who apparently writes about the Dark Overlord, and there were Dark Overlord references in the, you know, so it's, I don't know, it's some trash crew, whatever. It's pretty funny. Sorry to all of our listeners at the FBI for finding
rough
it funny,
day.
But it was
rough,
yeah,
day at the office, funny. But a little bit funny.
Now, Adam, what do you do when you have a Patriot Act 215 authorization for a bunch of business records pertaining to hotel bookings, but the company is not American? Of course, I'm talking about booking.com apparently got hacked, and some years ago, and a new book claims that it was a hacker working for a US intelligence agency, What Done It. And apparently this attacker was after, you know, booking information for hotels in the, you know, and guest houses in the Middle East. You know, it's entirely plausible that US intelligence agency would be seeking this information. But again, I don't know really much about this book and how credible it is. Like, what's your read on this?
Well, it certainly sounds believable. I mean, as you say, I think just last week you said, you know, like hotels and airlines and telcos, that's the traditional
targets.
That's
the trifecta.
Yes, of second agencies. So, yeah, I mean, you know, from that point of view, it totally makes sense. Booking.com's pretty big, plenty of bookings in the Middle East. Why not? Like, that's a sensible thing to do. Go see if, you know, Osama bin Laden's booked a hotel or whatever. you can see that happening.
And that's how they got him. That place in Abbottabad was an Airbnb.
So, yeah, like, from that, totally believable. The book, as I say, as you said, like, we haven't read that, so we don't really know exactly what, you know, it claims. But, yeah, I mean, seems reasonable to me. The subsequent investigation into the breach uncovered that, you know, perhaps it was US intelligence, and then the company decided that they hadn't lost any sensitive personal information and didn't need to go talk to the Dutch privacy regulator, because this is kind of pre-GDPR, which that kind of also seems believable.
A company sweeping up a breach of their systems by an intelligence agency, they'd sweep that under the rug? No. No way.
I don't know how the attribution to US intelligence works, because, I mean, you know, the spooks are pretty reasonable at their OPSEC. So, I mean, unless they got some word from somewhere, because I think they involved some American firm in the investigation. So maybe there was some quiet kind of conversation in a pub somewhere that, like, maybe you want to let this one go, buddy, sort of thing. But yeah, we don't really know. So all of the individual bits of this totally seem believable to me, whether the whole story is. We don't really know, but...
And I guess the reason I introed this by talking about Patriot Act 215 is because that's exactly the type of information that the Patriot Act allows American intel to gather from American companies, right? Like,
yes.
You know, they need to fill in some paperwork and stuff, but it's business records for this reason. So, you know, booking.com being Dutch is what makes this kind of plausible, right?
Yeah, seems believable to me.
Now, Cyber WarCon is happening in the United States right now, and I got to say, looking at Twitter this morning, I was feeling a bit sad I wasn't there, actually, because it looks like a really, really great conference that I'd like to go to one day. Maybe next year, let's see. But there was a talk by a couple of Mandiant analysts, Ben Reed and Gabby Roncone, I'm not sure on the pronunciation there, but they were talking about Ghost Rider. Now, this is a disinformation and, you know, hacking crew that was originally thought to be Russian, but now the thinking is that they're actually from Belarus, which is interesting. I think the thing that's kind of tipped it is they had sort of these, you know, activities that seem to align well with Russian interests, but then recently they've just gone hard on stuff that's very specifically Belarusian.
Yeah, I mean, that does make a lot of sense, I guess, that, you know, Belarusian interests and Russian interests are relatively aligned, and, you know, you may not be able to tell those apart previously.
Well, some of them, you know, like, I don't know that they're as one. I think they've got a complicated relationship, Belarus.
They do. Threaten to cut off Europe's gas pipeline, I guess, you know, of their own initiative, maybe, you know, not entirely aligned. But yeah, obviously, now that the situation in Belarus is a bit more dynamic, and the campaigns have been targeting, you know, all of the countries that have land borders with Belarus, plus a bunch of campaigns domestically in opposition in Belarus, does kind of line up. The Mandiant researchers have also said they have some technical attribution, you know, some infrastructure that does point back to Minsk and potentially military apparatus in Minsk. So,
You know, it's embarrassing for the EU, who declared in September that some member states have associated Ghost Rider with the Russian state. Whoops.
Yes. Well, you know, attribution's real hard and yeah. Yes.
Yeah, a little bit of egg on faces, I guess, is what I'm getting at there. But they did a lot of, yeah, misinformation, you know, anti-NATO misinformation stuff and some good old hacking. Lily Hay Newman had that write-up for Wired. And yeah, as I say, I'm really kind of sad because it looked like there were quite a lot of good talks at that conference. And that was certainly an interesting one. Oh, man, here we go. Emotet is back, baby. Woo!
Yes, reports are in that the TrickBot, remains of the TrickBot botnet have been seen dropping Emotet again. And this was, of course, with a botnet that was taken out a while ago now, some years back, I think. They did
I think it was just last year, wasn't it?
Was it last year? Yeah, they, the authorities took over the command and control network and like mass uninstalled Emotet.
Yeah.
From all the machines they had it, which was a pretty, you know, pretty smooth move. But yeah, it sounds like the Emotet crew is back. And in the past, you know, there has been cooperation between TrickBot and Emotet in terms of dropping each other. So, you know, probably not a surprise there. But yeah, for all the people that were celebrating Emotet's death, you know, it's risen from the grave. You know, it's probably not going to be as effective as widespread as it was previously.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's like someone's dusted off the source, you know, compiled a new version and they got some friends at TrickBot. Hey, can we get this going? Because their idea is, right, they're going to spin it up again via some TrickBot installations and then they can get their spam cranking again, right, to try to turn themselves back into a self-sourcing pudding. But I think the reason Emotet was so successful is because it got so big, right? Like it sort of got so big and so unwieldy that it was kind of difficult to contain. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Emotet, the sequel. This time it's personal.
And especially given that there's quite a lot of people in this industry who, you know, spent a lot of time and effort, you know, investigating and fighting Emotet, I'm sure quite a few of them are going to be a bit salty about it coming back, and they may get more attention than the average, you know, kind of botnet might get, like a fresh one that doesn't have a bunch of history, whereas there's going to be, you know, researchers who are going to be all, I'm a go look at that, you know, for historical reasons, and they may have a rougher ride.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, we don't really have much ransomware stuff to talk about this week, which is a little bit weird, but it looks like health systems in Canada are still recovering from a pretty disastrous attack that resulted in people's like chemotherapy and elective surgery being delayed. But it looks like that they are bringing things back online at the moment. Is that right?
Yes. So this is for health systems in Newfoundland and Labrador in Canada. And this is a health system that covers something like, 13,000 employees, so a pretty reasonable size. It looks like hackers stole a bunch of data, you know, up to, I think, 14 years in some cases worth of patient and employee data, along with other kind of, you know, the equivalent of social security numbers in Canada as well. So pretty, you know, widespread intrusion, delayed surgeries, pretty significant. It didn't seem to get as much coverage as some other, you know, intrusions into hospital systems have gotten, but anything that interrupts, you know, healthcare stuff is, you know, always really terrible to read about.
Yeah, no, it is. And there is one affecting various companies in Australia, like Frontier HR, like Frontier Payroll Systems. They've had some sort of issue and it is causing a bit of drama because they are like one of those outsourced payroll companies. There's not heaps of coverage on that, but I think that's one that we'll be hearing more about in coming days.
It's certainly impacted organisations in New Zealand. You know, they have customers over here as well for payroll.
Yeah, so I think it's like, you know, whole government departments here in Australia will use Frontier to process payroll. And I think it's a little bit early to see what the impact of that one's going to be. But, you know, I'm not sitting here in front of a pile of ransomware-related news stories, which is interesting. And we've got this interesting situation that's developed in the United States where you've got the White House basically saying, see, this is a solved problem. You know, the emergency's over because, you know, a gas pipeline hasn't been ransomwared recently. And then you've got the FBI turning up and doing congressional testimony and saying, we have observed no change in, you know, sort of ransomware volumes and seriousness. Now, a lot of journos have been writing that up as like, this is a conflict, you know, war between the FBI and the White House. And, you know, I actually wrote a tweet earlier today just saying, well, you know, it's kind of a bit silly seeing this framed as some sort of, you know, US government rift. But then Dustin Volz, who works for the Wall Street Journal, he sort of took issue about that because I was kind of targeting something he'd written. So he replied to me and he's like, look, you know, come on, these guys, like these FBI guys, when they're going to do congressional testimony and they say something like that, that is so clearly at odds with what the White House is saying, they know what they're doing. So he's of the opinion that the rift is real. And I think he's convinced me of that. So it is kind of interesting that you do have the White House and CISA and the FBI all sort of saying different things, you know?
Yeah, I mean, his argument in that case did seem pretty compelling, right? That they don't get up there and just kind of wing it, right? There is a bunch of review and they are sensitive to the optics of what they're saying. So, yeah, like that does seem real. And we have seen a little bit of argy-bargy between, you know, in terms of what the results of the, you know, the American government's attempts to minimize ransomware have been. And, you know, they are making progress. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, it does seem a bit...
Well, the FBI says there's been no change, right? So they're saying there hasn't been progress. And I just think it's interesting when you've got two different groups looking at the problem from different perspectives, right? Yes. I mean, from the White House's perspective, Colonial Pipeline getting ransomware is kind of a matter for the White House. But, you know, a bunch of hospitals getting owned, like, is that really... Does that really rise to the level of something that belongs in, like, the president's office? I mean, I'd argue it does, actually. But I can see how someone might argue it the other way. And meanwhile, the FBI is kind of looking at it... The broader spectrum of this activity, right? So, you know, they're not as focused on whether or not we're dealing with four or five of these really mega high profile events. They're sort of more looking at this as a crime ecosystem as a whole. So, I mean, I can kind of understand how they'd see it differently, but Dustin's definitely right when he says, no, man, the FBI know what they're doing when they say this stuff, you know?
Well, I mean, I guess anything that moves the situation along and gets things done is good by me. And if they have to have a little bit of, you know, pointing fingers at each other to make that happen, then that's fine with me. Like, let's get on with it. And, you know, we do have a few stories in the news this week of things happening, you know, on the back of this, you know, kind of fight against ransomware and the operators in the ecosystem. And, you know, it's too soon to say that it's worked, but it certainly feels like there is momentum where previously there wasn't to me.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And I think it is too early to say, but it does feel like, yeah, something. I just think they got to follow through, right? Yes. Like, I think at this point, you know, if you're the White House and you're saying, well, you know, mission accomplished, it's like, no, but maybe, you know, maybe you just want to have a small team dedicated to suppressing this stuff, right? Because it's not going to take all that much. You know, it is worth having a permanent team, you know, in the IC and military world that can work on ransomware suppression, right? So, and, you know, people, I think, say that proponents of offensive action against ransomware crews think, you know, and I'm obviously one of them, I don't think it's going to solve the problem entirely. Like, I've never said that. I just think it's insane not to do it because it will actually help. Anyway, moving on. And this is one from Catalin Kimpanu. Apparently the head of the Polish CERT got shit canned for posting negative things about the Polish government on his personal Facebook page. And that's causing some drama over there.
Yeah, it does sound like a bit of drama. There is an open letter from the 40 employees of the Polish CERT on the CERT website now, kind of saying that they support their boss. Apparently he's been there something like 20 years and instrumental, you know, in how effective the Polish CERT has been. Like, they've done really great work over the years. And yeah, they are saying this guy is, you know, integral to that. There's also a little bit of finger pointing there because the kind of governance structure of the Polish CERT
they shouldn't have really been able to do this. They kind of went outside the normal processes to fire him.
Yes. I mean, I guess, you know, obviously insulting your own government on Facebook is probably a thing you ought to be able to do without getting fired. But, you know, on the other hand, maybe, yeah, I don't know. That does seem like a thing you ought to be able to do.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think the Polish government is of the sort of new modern right variety currently, mm-hmm. right? So they like to do these sorts of things. He could have joined the Krebs Club and been fired by tweet. But looks like they didn't quite do it that way. What else we got? Oh, man, this is an unfortunate attempted holiday. And I love reading about these crooks. In this case, it was a guy who was laundering ransomware profits, booked himself a holiday to Mexico, didn't quite go planned. Another one from Catalin at the Record here.
Yes, this is Denis Dubnikov, founder of the Egg Change and Crypto Coyote cryptocurrency exchanges. FBI said that he handled something like $400,000 worth of cryptocurrency from Ryuk as part of their payment process. Yes, went to Mexico. The Mexican authorities detained him at the border, turned him around, put him on a plane to the Netherlands, whereupon he was detained by the Dutch authorities, who are now going to extradite him to the US.
Yeah, I'm guessing Schiphol was like where he flew in from, but I don't know. You would have thought if he flew in from the Netherlands, they would have got him on the way out and maybe not in Mexico. Yeah. I don't know. But either way, that's a lot of flying. And
that is a lot of flying, yes.
Not such a happy ending.
There's a bunch of QQing on some of the Russian forums about, you know, how a Russian citizen can be detained when going for a holiday in Mexico. Maybe don't go on a holiday to Mexico if you're a Russian, you know, kind of cybercrime money launderer. That seems like a bad life choice. So
yeah, they're sort of getting salty and saying the government needs to step up for this guy. And it's like, he's a money launderer. What do you expect? Anyway, they're learning.
Just stick to going to the Black Sea, my friends. That's, you know, you can't go to Mexico. Don't go to Thailand. Don't go to Mexico.
Do not. Stick to Crimea. Stick to Crimea. Now, let's talk about one of this week's, you know, InfoSec Twitter dramas.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I know. But I kind of want to touch on this one because yes. I kind of feel like, you know, I do have a side on this.
No, it's an interesting, this is an interesting debate. Like, there's more than average for InfoSec Twitter.
Yes, exactly. So there's a company called Randori. They disclosed a bug to Palo Alto Networks. It's a bad one, man. 9.8 CVSS. And they disclosed
like stack it to buffer overflow. Yeah. Stack buffer overflow. And they don't have address randomization. And like, what year is it, Palo?
Yeah,
what
but
year?
We know that Palo Alto loves to run architectures that don't support ASLR, right? Like, this is something that we know about them.
It does. They can just turn it off.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so they reported this bug to Palo Alto Networks, and Palo Alto patched it. And then someone noticed that the timeline was like, you know, there was like this year mystery gap, which is when Rand and I were actually using the bug in red team exercises. And, you know, there's been a lot of hand-wringing and people getting weird about it. But I kind of think, well, it's, you know, they don't really have an obligation to report bugs that they find to vendors, you know. I mean, it's nice that they did, but of course they're going to use it for a while. I mean, they're very useful in red team exercises. And so the people who are really criticizing them here, I don't think they really understand necessarily that, you know, what a red team exercise is. Do you yes. know what I mean? Like, you're not testing the patching, right? No. You're not testing someone's patching and their patch levels. You're basically seeing if their blue team or if their SOC is going to catch you when you come in with something like this, right? So O-Day is helpful. And sure, you can have a starting point like local admin or a shell on one of these VPN devices or whatever, but then it's not a true simulation. So I don't know. I kind of think that they're okay on this. What do you think, Adam?
I mean, I also agree with you. And of course, my perspective is, you know, comes from also having been a red teamer. And yeah, having O-Day on the shelf is super useful. And I came from a school of red teaming where we didn't really do phishing as an entry point, like, because it was, you know, we were old school hackers and you hack things by hacking software. And so a typical entry for us would be through a bug. And typically it's going to be something new, right? We go find a bug, a zero day in a relevant piece of software and break in that way. And that was like how we did it for the first 5 or 6 years until someone showed me how phishing worked. Like, wow, that's really easy. Why didn't we just do this all along? This is way, way easier. But yeah, like having zero day is kind of normal. Your adversaries have bugs. And the idea that, like, I've seen a couple of people whinging and saying, "Oh, it's not fair to the blue team." It's like,
what are you talking about?
Fair? Like, this is not a game. Like, no. we are adversary simulation. This is an adversary simulation exercise, and we can bypass the need to have and burn expensive O-Day by doing, you know, assume the breach start, like starting as an internal, starting as, you know, a point in the network that makes sense, you know, at the entry point for a third party, you know, outsource provider, something like that, where you can't. I can't go break into HP and use them as an entry point to simulate that. You know, I have to start from inside the organization where HP would enter or something like that. So, you know, there's no element of fairness here. Like, this is, you know, we are doing what adversaries do. And the point of the blue team is to be able to detect generically that you've been broken into by whatever mechanism, and then the subsequent activity and lateral movement and escalation and exfiltration, all those sorts of things. So, yeah, that debate on InfoSec Twitter did surprise me.
Yeah, me too. I'm like, you know what? Yeah, red teams test blue teams. You know, that's what they do. Yeah,
exactly.
And if your blue team is going to just say, I just assume that everything is patched and nothing is vulnerable, like, what is it doing? You know? What?
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know how much stuff is, I mean, I'm trying to think how many times that I have done, you know, red team initial entry, and it's not through bugs, and it's not through lack of patching, and it's through like misconfiguration. Where does that fit on this scale? Like, that's kind of site local zero day is how I think about it.
Yeah.
And then my approach to local PrivX was also, you know, usually very similar. Very rarely would use bugs, because it makes sense to use site local things because you're adding more value that way. You're telling them things that are unique to their infrastructure rather than stuff they can just go apply a patch from Microsoft or, you know, Red Hat or whoever else, you know?
I also feel like the critics here miss something, which is that, you know, if they had to disclose this to Palo Alto like a year earlier, like, it's not like that's going to meaningfully improve the state of things, you know? Like, it's not going to make that much of a difference. But I do feel like, so this is the sort of bug, though, that I do feel like if NSA stumbled on this one, it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't survive the VEP process to be kept for use. Like, this would be one that would have to be patched, right? So you do have to have a different standard when you're dealing with, like, government agencies, which is very sad for NSA.
Yeah. And, I mean, you know, we would do the same thing, you know, even as a private sector red team. We would have an equities conversation. Like, we'd have a formal process. It would just be a, you know, like, sit around the office and, like, can we really keep this? Or do we have to, like, you know, do we really?
Would you have kept this one?
This one, I mean, if it was a default, like if it was a widespread config, probably not. Like if it was a thing that I could argue is
dangerous,
is properly dangerous, or, you know, just consider the likelihood of parallel discovery, you know, consider the impacts, you know, what sort of customers, you know, we would probably look around our own house, like look around New Zealand and say, like, who do we really care about that runs this? You know, do we need to go talk to someone locally and get this patched in advance, which we've done on a few occasions? You know, we find bugs and go, yeah, I don't want to have to deal with, I don't want to have to roll instant response on a Friday because someone else does this bug. So that equities process has a bunch of self-interest in it, of course. But yeah, I mean, we would do the same sort of thing. And
was this a by default thing, though?
So the specifics, I'm a little unclear about it. Some kind of, you know, to reach the Stack Overflow was like, I think you had to reflect it off an internal interface via like a request smuggling. So it was a little bit fiddly. And in that respect, seemed unlikely to be discovered, you know, super, super easily. So yeah, I wasn't 100% clear from the reporting if it was just a straight up going to work from the outside or whether it required a bit of extra thing. But I mean, overall, SSL VPNs are a thing that the NSA recommend against anyway, so take that into consideration.
All righty. Moving on, and Rohammer. Rohammer is just refuses to go away, and this is some really interesting research we're talking about here. Both of the last piece and this piece were written by Dan Gooden over at Ars Technica, but apparently researchers have figured out how to Rohammer DDR4 memory, and that's bad.
Yeah, this is some really, really interesting research and, you know, a great example of really solid academic security research. And, you know, pesky physics ruins the day for everyone again, right? Another way to flip bits in very, very tiny semiconductors. In this case, the researchers sat down and traditional Rohammer techniques. So Rohammering works by doing kind of repeated writes to memory cells that are adjacent to another cell, and you end up with kind of electrons leaking out of one row of memory into the next one over and flipping bits. And traditionally, that's done by, you know, kind of hammering either a row above or a row below or both at the same time. And this research, they went through and changed the patterns that they were using to not be uniform. So more uneven, I guess, or different frequencies of hammering at different places around the memory cell that you're trying to target. And the mitigations that RAM manufacturers put in place previously to target row hammering are kind of proprietary. Like, they're inside the memory controller gubbins, and each vendor has done it slightly differently, and it's not 100% clear. And the result of this research was that the mitigation techniques put in place on regular DRAM are kind of effective against the previously published attacks, but not necessarily at this kind of slightly different, you know, fuzzy variant of it. And they fuzzed a bunch of patterns to find which ones worked well and then walked those across memory to figure out, you know, if they affected all the different brands of RAM that they had available to them from three major vendors, covering something like 94% of the market. So, you know, pretty significant. And, you know, Rohammer being back and in force and, you know, applying to, you know, a large amount of consumer devices, that's pretty significant. And if we do see this weaponized, because, you know, we've got so much experience from the previous iterations of Rohammer of how to use this.
Yeah.
They demonstrated stealing crypto keys, you know, altering, flipping bits in authentication code to do PrivEsc, all those kinds of things. But breaking out of browser sandboxes, breaking across virtual machine boundaries, these are all things we've already done with the Rohammer primitive previously. So really, really interesting.
Wouldn't you think, though, that generic detections of this in software would be quite easy? Because that's what I've always thought about this.
That's a good question. Like, whether the OS has enough capacity to be able to spot these kinds of patterns and to do so without the without a performance penalty that's crippling? I don't know. Yeah. That's a good question. What the software mitigations would be. One of the hardware mitigation options, of course, is ECC RAM. So for expensive servers and data centers and the sorts of things that runs, you know, high-end public cloud, you know, first-tier public cloud, you would expect is probably all ECC RAM. And this technique doesn't specifically work against ECC, but that's not a, I mean, ECC was never designed specifically for this. That kind of, you know, checksumming and error correction at a hardware level wasn't, it wasn't meant to be a security mechanism. It was meant for, you know, cosmic ray bit flips. So we may see further research into this general, you know, applicability of this general technique towards other, you know, other types of memory with ECC correction. And that would be a big deal. I mean, if you
I think they've already had some success targeting ECC RAM as well.
Yeah, so we saw that with earlier generation RAM. So I think, you know, the idea that it's possible is believable, and you know, the research. I'm sure they're sitting down planning the next research.
Good news, everyone.
Good news.
And we got another one, you know, looking at hardware from Dan Gooden, another one from Dan Gooden here, looking at some research into TPM, like by like getting access to TPM enclaves on Intel chips. You need physical access, but like the TPM enclaves are there to prevent people with physical access from being able to do this. So this is that situation where it's like, okay, requires physical access, but I will allow it.
Mm-hmm. So this research looks into a mechanism to recover the hardware trust root keys out of Intel CPUs that are then used to kind of bootstrap the rest of the secure elements, right? The TPMs and other, you know, the management processor, the like ring minus, whatever it is, two or three of it, they call it the management engine stuff. All things which can be used to then control aspects of the chip, control access to the firmware. And of course, in the case of the TPM, pull out keys to bypass BitLocker to be able to decrypt the machine. And you can certainly imagine that there's plenty of use cases for having, you know, seized a machine in a law enforcement context, for example, where you want to be able to decrypt a BitLocker, TPM-backed BitLocker decrypted disk. So very, very real attack in that respect. Actually physically doing it, we don't know the specific details. It's some kind of bug in a debug interface on the Intel chip that has more access than it should, that you can then use the bootstrap up into code exec or, you know, key leaking or whatever else from there. So pretty significant research, and of course fixing it for Intel is going to be difficult. I mean, they've pushed out some firmware, like, you know, chip firmware or CPU firmware upgrades, and if you've got the like downgrade protection turned on, then perhaps that's sufficient, but there's just a lot of devices in the field that are never ever going to get, you know, CPU firmware upgrades.
Yeah.
The other thing I thought that was interesting about this particular thing is the original research came out of Positive Technologies.
Ah, those
now
guys.
Good friends in Positive Technologies.
Good friends.
Are they allowed to buy Intel CPUs anymore?
I don't even know how all this entities list stuff works. You know, I don't know what it means. Can they? Is it? Are they just restricted from restricted technology? Can they buy a Big Mac? I don't know. It's all very confusing.
But yes, good work. Really great research.
yeah, it is. And they often do really great research.
They do. Very practical for some reason.
We got a write-up here from the Daily Swig, written by James Walker, talking about a historical bug in G Suite that... That I figured, like, even though this thing got patched, like, I think years ago. Yeah, 2018. Yeah. But, like, holy shit.
This is real bad. And, like, as a G Suite admin in 2018, like, I look at this and I just rub my temples thinking, oh, lordy, lordy.
Yeah, there, but so for the grace of God goes I. I mean, that's what I thought, because I am technically the G Suite admin for, you know, or workspaces or whatever they call it now. I am the admin for Risky Biz, and, like, wow. Yes.
Yeah. So this was a bug in the like domain management portion, like our administrative interface of G Suite that you'd use to, you know, set up domains and things. And there was a process for adding super admin users to your G Suite account. And this bug was just a straight up in at some point in the flow, you could just switch out the account number and account name to be somebody else's G Suite account. And it would just add an admin account to their thing that you controlled.
Yeah, you could just be like a super admin of whoever's like G Suite account.
Of everybody else's G Suite.
With a post. All you needed to do was create one account that had, you know, you needed to your own account under whatever identifier, and you could just add yourself with one post. Like, yeah, make me a super admin of this guy's G Suite. What the hell?
Oof. Yeah. So he reported it to Google, you know, at the time. Google paid him a bounty. We don't know how much. I hope it was a lot.
Yeah.
It better be a lot, because oof, that's a bug. And yeah, subsequently been fixed. But oh man, like I pasted that in our work chat, and there's a few people going, "Damn, I wish I had that bug."
Yeah,
you know, 2 years ago, because that would have been a good time.
The researcher's name is Cameron Vincent, and I think he's reaching back into his archives to talk about stuff that's old that he can talk about now. But
yeah,
yikes!
What a bug, man! What a bug.
What do we got? Another one from Catalan here. Some like cam site called Strip Chat actually put all of its user data and data on its models into like some publicly exposed zero auth Elastic, which is less than ideal. And you know, I don't know if anyone actually downloaded that data, but I do find it interesting that there's been similar leaks at other cam sites, and you just think this is a safety issue for the people who sell services on those sites, right? It's pretty serious. You'd think there's money in this industry. You'd think they'd take some of it and spend it on security. God.
You really would hope, but, I mean, evidence does seem to suggest that they don't, which is real crappy because, I mean, that's an industry that has so much exploitation in it already. Like, this is just an extra, you know, insult on top of everything else, you know, that you would face working in that field. So, yeesh. But, yeah, I think the data was on the internet unauthed for a matter of days. So we don't know that it got leaked, but...
Yeah, but it's still a troubling sign for that industry.
It really is.
And finally, we're going to end with a comedy story, again from The Record, again from Catalan Kimpanu. Someone's gone out there and defaced a bunch of WordPress sites. So they defaced some of the pages on these WordPress sites saying, "You've been ransomwared. Give us $6,000 in Bitcoin. Here's the address." But they haven't actually ransomwared anything. They've just... like put some HTML there that says they've been ransomware. And the best thing is, right, like if someone had done this even 5 years ago, a lot of people would have been sending money to that address. But it looks like no one's falling for it, so that's nice.
Yeah, that's a good story for once. You know, 300 boxes owned and nothing went horribly wrong other than a few files overwritten or, you know, a few web pages injected. Apparently it was some like WordPress plugin, you know, they had a bug in it, so you know, pretty much normal on that side. But yeah, the old people don't seem to be so keen to fall for the old fake ransomware scheme so much anymore, which that's good, right?
Hooray. Yes, good news story to end on the week, you know.
Good news.
It involves a bunch of boxes getting owned, but nothing bad really happening.
but just not that badly.
Not that badly, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure, and we'll do it all again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was CyberCX's Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news headlines. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with HD Moore from Rumble. In addition to Rumble being a Risky Biz sponsor, I am a small beer advisor to the company, so I need to disclose that. I do have an interest. And yeah, if you're not familiar with Rumble, it is a lightweight scanner you run on your network and it tells you what's on it. That is the basic description. But that basic description really does undersell it because Rumble is pretty freaky when you see it in action. It can see stuff that you just wouldn't expect it to be able to see. It can find networks in your networks you didn't know there. It can find VMs you didn't even know were running in your environment. And of course, you can find Rumble at rumble.run. Anyway, basically, every time I talk to HD, he's added a whole bunch of new tricks to Rumble that are good to talk about. So yeah, I just asked him what's new in the product. And they've added cloud service API support and census data ingestion to Rumble. So here is HD talking about that.
So a lot of our customers are, you know, obviously everyone uses the cloud in some regards these days. You either have a totally external kind of cloud island someplace that hosts your external facing stuff, or it's actually more likely these days is your cloud internal environments are actually wired up to your internal corporate network through VPN connections. So we're seeing more folks want to have a combined view of what's on their corporate network, what's inside their cloud environment, inside the VPC itself, and also what's visible externally through services like Census.
Yeah, so I'm curious too, because you just mentioned, oh, you know, they're often connected via VPN, right? And one way to do that sort of scanning would be just to, you know, scan the other direction through the VPN, right, into that environment. And that doesn't require an API integration. So why have you done it this way with an actual, you know, why have you done it the right way, HD? So why is there an API integration to get this done?
Well, in general, we try to avoid credentials, right? So we really don't want to be credential first for anything like that, because kind of the most of the value that we provide is unauthenticated, fast internal discovery and external discovery in some cases too. What we noticed, though, is some customers were scanning all of RFC 1918 space and saying, hey, I've got this weird 10 net somewhere else that has all this weird stuff on it. What is that? And we're like, oh, it's actually your AWS environment. You're actually routing your external AWS into your internal network. And they go, great, but who owns that? What is that instance? What tag is on it, right? Which team even runs that thing? And so for us, adding the ability to connect to the AWS instances, do multi-account, SDS assume role, enumerate all their sub-accounts, all that kind of fun stuff, means we can now put owners and tags and, you know, all the fun tracking information.
Okay, I get it now, right? So you actually are doing a network scan into that environment, but then you're using data that you get from the API to enrich it and actually say what that stuff is, who the owner is, et cetera, et cetera.
And vice versa too. We're seeing cases where folks say, hey, I did this big cloud enumeration, but how come I'm not scanning these other assets of there? Oh, my security groups are wrong, or the VPN connection is down, or this thing's broken. So it's a combination of like enriching the data that we see on the active scanning side, but also knowing what we're missing by what's not in, you know, what's not part of your scan scope, but is definitely connected to your network.
It's interesting because, you know, I talk to a lot of companies that try to sort of shoehorn some sort of cloud functionality into a product that's not really a cloud product, but it sounds like this thing, it is actually an area where it makes sense. I'm just sort of sitting here trying to think of a way to criticize it. It's not coming naturally though, so that's good.
And we definitely scratch our heads a bit. We're like, what, you know, what's the value of an API only discovery? Because if you're, you know, any customer can use the CLI from AWS, enumerate instances their own way, go to the web console. So the question for us is like, what can we do that actually makes it more useful than that? And it was combining the results of the active scan with the API results, but also doing some really neat things with API results that a lot of folks don't really think about. Like, for example, we can do OS fingerprinting by figuring out what AMI someone's using on their instance. So we go a little bit deeper. In some cases, like with VMware, for example, we can tell you whether Windows Defender is installed or not on a virtual machine by querying the host API without touching the guest OS at all.
Yeah. And you've got a Census integration as well, which I find really interesting because, you know, Census provides a lot of the data that's very, very useful for doing discovery of external assets, right? That's a fantastic thing. What I'm curious about though, so I'm guessing that's the same sort of thing, right? That's for enrichment. That's for, hey, we've got this host that we know routes to the outside world. Is Census seeing anything about that host? Is that the sort of thing?
Yeah, definitely. There's really two cases though. There's folks who are scanning their external environments and want to see what's visible in Rumble, but also what's visible from an external perspective from Census, for example. And other folks who use external IP addresses internally, and they want to make sure that any of those internal addresses, even though they're using public IP space, really shouldn't be reachable from the internet. But if they are, they definitely want to know about it.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm curious too to know, could you use Rumble with the Census component and the cloud API component and not with the network component? Because then all of a sudden you've actually built a pretty valuable sort of external asset discovery tool, right? Kind of by accident.
We're actually seeing that in the case for integrations like CrowdStrike, because the majority, especially during the pandemic, the majority of CrowdStrike instances were not on your network. They're people on their home networks or, you know, people's phones. They were very much almost all off-network assets. So we've got some customers where half of their assets are off-network, never scanned by Rumble, but still tracked by Rumble.
But I mean, I was talking more about almost like at an infrastructure level, right? Like people's, you know, online deployments for web applications and whatnot. I mean, is it going to go there or not? Not just yet.
We're doing some of that. We're starting off with like, let's look at everything that's externally visible, externally reachable inside your cloud environments, and then working our way out from there. So with AWS, for example, we added support for ELBs. We identify both the V4, V6 internal and external interfaces of each ELB, and then tie those back into your VPCs and then your scanning and your external facing scans.
So when people ask me to explain Rumble, I always talk about how it's asset discovery, but for internal. And it sounds like I'm going to have to stop doing that.
It's got an IP address, we cover it basically. And even then, even in some cases we don't know. With a lot of our like EDR integrations, we're identifying assets, even if we don't know what the IPs are. With the VMware integration, we can tell you which VMs are running, even if they're not actually on our network or attached to anything at all. If you've got a VM with no network interface at all, we're still going to report it.
How does, through the API, right?
Through the API, but we do a few more bits of analysis on top of that. So one of the cool things you can get out of the guest networking tools and the guest networking APIs is you can enumerate like all your Docker level your Docker interfaces of your guest OS through the VMware host API, which is insane. So you actually get some deeper analysis into the guest OS than you'd ever expect from a VMware API at the host level.
It's funny, right? Because you've said it before, the line you like to use is we eat the whole buffalo. And that's just a great example of that, right? Which is one, it's like every time, you know, and I've told this story on the show before, but I remember when you were showing me like early iterations of this, you know, you had a bag of parlor tricks and I'm like, okay, that's great. That's a bag of parlor tricks, but that's not a that's not a product. And then you added 1,000 more parlor tricks and it became a product. That works really well. So, you know, that's
kind of fun. We basically look at every possible bit we can extract from the data we get. So VMware is really fun because, you know, there's a standard VMware SDK. It works great. But our view was like, let's not use SDK. Let's take what the SDK gives us, serialize it down to the raw JSON, then pick through it with a fine-tooth comb and find everything useful and interesting in it, and then serialize it back out. So it does make the developments a little funky because instead of using the SDKs to re-serialize the JSON, we have to like build our own custom structs to be able to pull the right bits out of it.
Now, look, we got a bit of a customer story here, too, that sort of ties into what we've been talking about, which is a pharmaceutical production line. They managed to get themselves ransomware, and you guys came in as part of the cleanup. Is that right?
That's right. A lot of folks will reach out to us for both figuring out what was on the network before an event happened and also making sure that everything's restored properly after the fact. And also knowing, like, hey, just what's out there. Like, in this organization, they just didn't have a lot of inventory at that particular manufacturing site. And after the event happened, they're like, well, we need to make sure we know what's on the network at all times, and we want to make sure that things change, we get ahead of it real quick. There's a similar situation where MSP was working with a small city government. The city was hit with ransomware, and the only record they had of anything on the network prior to that point was this one-off Rumble scan from this MSP. So the MSP reached out saying, hey, I know I deleted my account 6 months ago. Do you happen to have a backup, please? Yeah. So that was one of the cases where we ended up using that backup to help the IT of the city government restore the entire operation of the city after a ransomware attack.
Now, one of the early use cases that you and I spoke about for Rumble was this concept of like having a tool available to you. So when some device turns out to be really devastatingly vulnerable or bad, you know, people can quickly use Rumble to find that device in their environments. And of course, this was kind of a theoretical use case at the time that we talked about it because Rumble is quite new. But it turns out that is a popular use case now. You've got people looking for stuff like Hikvision IP cameras and more recently, PAX point of sale devices, which is that company in Florida that was like raided by the FBI, and it's still a bit of a mystery as of time of recording. But yeah, why don't you walk us through what some of the customers are doing with regard to some of this rapid response stuff?
Yeah, sure thing. So the normal kind of vulnerability response flow is, hey, there's a big new bug, big new security issue, whatever it is, whether it's SolarWinds or the PAX stuff, you know, go into your vuln management system, figure out what stuff you possibly have, rescan the network, looking for things that are vulnerable to that thing, and then go respond. The problem is that takes like a week sometimes, if not more, to get a scan window, to get that data. What we try to really focus on at Rumble is turning your network into kind of a knowledge base that you can search ahead of the time. So if someone says, hey, there's a new device that we think is suspect or sketchy or was raided by the FBI last week in Florida, you can quickly search your entire inventory and say, is there anything manufactured by PAX Technologies on my network at all? Or are there any SolarWinds servers? Are there any Exchange servers that I don't know about? So we tend to have like all the data is already there before you start. And as a result, we tend to be the first tool that a lot of management teams look at to respond to new incidents.
Before we got recording, you also mentioned something interesting to me, which is that it's not the vuln management teams who tend to be leading these hunts, right? For devices, it's the incident response teams.
That's true, yeah. The incident response teams tend to be a little more tactical. The other ones who are hair on fire, running around, trying to figure things out. A lot of the vuln management teams are doing a great job of maintaining the vuln management system, keeping track of doing patch remediation, but they're not the ones kind of in the line of fire in a lot of cases to respond to these in the news events.
Yeah. I mean, is it kind of a recent trend that people will just proactively look for a vulnerable class of device to squash it? I mean, because it just feels like over the last year or two, it's got to that point where, yeah, there's just some stuff that you immediately have to fix or rip out, right? Like, whereas previously it's like, oh, well, that's good to know. If we see one, we'll deal with it. But now it's search and destroy.
I feel like the frequency has gone up a lot too. If you look at, you know, even like, you know, 2020 versus 2021, the number of like new high visibility security issues coming out weekly has just gone through the roof, it seems like. Maybe I'm just getting old and time's compressing, but it does feel like there's a lot more of these, a lot more frequently. And as a result, folks are having to spend almost their, you know, a large portion of their time keeping track of the stuff and getting ahead of it.
It feels like the stuff people are searching and destroying, you know, it's often either really old products and architectures that are just never going to be securable, or IoT style devices, like again, like the Hikvision cameras and stuff, right? So it's less about finding, you know, in a general sense, it's less about finding some malfunctioning Microsoft SharePoint server or something, because, you know, we've got pretty good at getting our hands around that problem, and more about getting our hands around the stuff that it's like, well, there's this advisory out, this thing's broken and it's going to be really hard to fix, so let's go squash it. I mean, that feels like it's become something enterprises have had to learn how to do over the last couple of years. And that's new. It is new.
Yeah, that's definitely a change from the old model, right? Where it's very much like, you know, scan and patch. these days, you assume anything you know about, you're already patching. Otherwise, you're not doing your job. And you're really just trying to find the things that were otherwise underneath your radar. So it's not a question of like, you know, is my Exchange server unpatched? It's like, do I have an Exchange server and where is it?
All right. Well, HD, thank you so much for joining us. Just to give us a quick walkthrough on some of the new features. It's always a lot of fun to talk to you. The feedback from the Risky Business listeners has been very, very solid. So I'm happy to share that with you. And we'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Appreciate it, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
That was HD Moore there from Rumble, and you can find Rumble at rumble.run. And there is a free version, of course. It's one of those things that kind of has to be seen to be believed. So go grab a copy, have a play with it. I honestly, hand on heart, believe that pretty much everyone's going to use Rumble in the future. It is that good. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in a couple of days with a soapbox edition of the show. We're talking about the history of DDoS with Sean Leach from Fastly, and that one was actually heaps more fun than I was expecting, so I definitely recommend you check it out. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.